Hi, Paul. Thanks for the great introduction. Today I'm here with Jor Law. He's a lawyer with a law firm he'll tell you about. And he's got a focal point in a couple of very interesting areas, both for individual investors who are looking at ways of being able to invest, and also for entrepreneurs who are looking for money with some ideas of some places to go. So, Jor, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell the people about yourself?
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be on. So I actually wear two hats within the industry. I have a law firm that I'm a co-founder of. It's called Holmeyer Law, and it's essentially a corporate transactional boutique. We focus on transactions in the mergers and acquisitions, finance, lending, securities, and startups primarily. We're most famous for our alternative finance practice, where we have a leading practice in the world for EB-5 finance and also crowdfunding. Separately, I also am co-founder of a company called VerifyInvestor.com. It is a technology platform that facilitates accredited investor verification, primarily serving the crowdfunding industry.
Great. One of the things that was interesting when I was talking to you about doing the interview was some things that you were talking about in terms of the crowdfunding, and you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on Title III and Title IV, but you were also talking about Title II. Why don't you bring people up to date on what's been happening with crowdfunding?
Yeah, let's maybe define crowdfunding as most of us understand it, and then crowdfunding as how you know, the laws understand it. And perhaps we'll attach a definition of crowdfunding. If you break down the words crowdfunding, it really is funding from the crowd, right? Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you know, people have been funding from the crowd for quite a while, you know, through IPOs and et cetera, publicly traded stocks. However, the catch was that most private companies were not allowed to crowdfund. They essentially had to raise money from their own private networks. And if you think about crowdfunding, meaning I'm funding from the crowd, which are largely people that I don't know, There was a sense that you had to protect people from the people that were raising money. You had to protect investors. And the reason why publicly traded companies didn't really seem to have that protection is because, you know, there was adequate information about those companies. So fast forward many, many years, and essentially under the Jobs Act, which was passed in April 2012, by President Obama, they allowed for private companies to essentially take advantage of the crowdfunding mechanism of fundraising. And they did this through the Jobs Act, which passed Title II, Title III, and Title IV. And the funny thing is, we all think of crowdfunding as, oh, I'm just getting money from the crowd. However, in the law, crowdfunding is actually just Title III, Regulation CF. Now, for the purpose of today's discussion, I think it's easier if we just kind of reference crowdfunding as the overall mechanism of funding from the crowd, mm-hmm. and talk about Title II, III, and IV as mechanisms to crowdfund. Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned before, Title III and Title IV have gotten quite a bit of focus, but that's only because they only recently became legal. Title II has been legal for a few years and is definitely the most powerful method of crowdfunding and most actively used in the industry. I've got some stats to share if you'd like.
Great. That would be good.
Yeah. So Title II was the first one to essentially become legal. Mm-hmm. Within the first 30 days, $2.2 billion were reported to have been raised by, or, you know, people were trying to raise $2.2 million. Within the first 5 months, that figure was $12 billion. In 2015, the SEC reported that issuers reported $38 billion through Title II. Compare that with Title III, became legal May 16th, 2016, so, you know, about 6.5 months ago, or 7 months ago now. In the first 6.5 months through the end of last year, only $15 million. Hmm. So 800 times less than, you know, what was done in Title II.
Right.
And Title IV was legalized on June 19th, 2015. And through December 31st, which is about, 1.5 years, there were 147 filings, 81 of which were qualified by the SEC. The 147 filings purported to raise $2.6 billion, of which, the 81 were only qualified for $1.5 billion. In actuality, $190 million were actually raised. The average maximum raise was $18 million. So if you look at it, Title II by far is much more active and useful as a crowdfunding tool than Title III and Title IV will probably ever be.
That's those are some pretty interesting statistics. one of the reasons why we weren't following Title II as closely is the when you read it as California Capital Partners would read it, that was you had to be a qualified investor in order to participate in Title II. So it was really the three and four that we were looking at as what's going to happen, and that's where a lot of the money's going to be coming from. And actually, one of the things that we thought about with Title III is the amount of money, given the amount of work that has to be done, that you can raise on a yearly basis just doesn't seem to fit a lot of early stage companies. $1 million a year is a lot of money to a lot of people. But when you're in a company that's in, let's say, in a technology space, that just doesn't seem to be enough. So could you talk a little bit about the differences from an entrepreneur's standpoint, if they're looking at Title II, III, and IV, what kinds of differences that they have to be able to show the government, what kinds of costs are also associated for them to be able to qualify for these?
Yeah, certainly. This is going to be a little bit of an involved topic.
Sure.
The main thing is for Title III and Title IV, the main advantage is that you can solicit non-accredited investors.
Right.
Whereas with Title II, it's your traditional Reg D private placement. You can only target accredited investors. And with the Title II offering, you actually not only should just target accredited investors, but you have to verify that they actually are accredited.
Mm-hmm.
So the trade-off with Title II essentially is that you can advertise to anyone, accredited or not, but ultimately when they subscribe and purchase their securities, they have to be accredited investors and you have to prove it. And because you were targeting accredited investors, which is obviously a much smaller part of the population than sure. non-accredited investors, a lot of people thought Title II would not be as helpful. However, what it turns out to be is that there are plenty of accredited investors, right? Each year in the U.S., they fund over $1 trillion. So that's a lot of money.
Sure.
And it turns out that accredited investors are more likely to invest. So now that you can target accredited investors and non-accredited investors, you have to understand, do non-accredited investors actually invest? Does the average, Joe actually go out and invest in small stocks?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that, they might not.
Good.
And therefore, the accredited investor pool is still quite powerful. The beauty of Title II is other than the need to prove that someone is accredited, right? So theoretically, if someone was accredited, now they just have to prove it, right? If they weren't lying in the first place, then they'd be able to prove that they were accredited. So you're accessing the exact same pool of investors as you were before that has invested, $1 trillion a year.
Now, let me just break in for a second because I want to ask a question that's relevant at this point. It used to be that the way that you got somebody to prove that they were an accredited investor was there's like seven different things that make you accredited, and they would hand you out a sheet if you were at some sort of a pitch fest, and you would have to sign the sheet and check the box that said that this is how I qualify. I have a net worth greater than $1 million, not including my house, or whatever way it was. It sounds like from the way you're saying it, though, that's not enough anymore, and it's up to the entrepreneur to make sure that they've got that verification.
Yes, and that's the downside of Title II. So the old way of doing things that raised $1 trillion a year is what's called a Reg D Rule 506B offering. And this was an offering where you targeted accredited investors only. You could not publicly solicit or generally advertise your offering. But once you've found an investor, so long as they essentially self-certified that they were an accredited investor, you could trust them on it, so long as you had no reason to believe that they were lying. Now, Title II created, another exemption, Rule 506C, also within Regulation D. And virtually all the rules are the same, except for now you can generally solicit, you can advertise, but you have to take extra steps to prove that someone is accredited. So the ones that were lying, you couldn't take their money. The ones that weren't lying, you'd still be able to take their money. And yeah. And that's what, that's what my company, verifyinvestor.com, does, mainly because, sometimes it's a little bit frustrating for the investor to go through this process. It's a little bit invasive. And for the company or entrepreneur doing it, it can quite a bit of liability can attach if they're not doing it properly.
One of the things that occurred when they came up with they changed the rules of accreditation a few years ago was a lot of people who were accredited investors in California, because at the time you could count your primary residence as part of your net worth. But then they came out and changed that rule, I guess, to get more consistent with places like around the world. I know in Canada, you can't use your primary residence either. All of a sudden, there were people that they might not have even known that they weren't accredited anymore.
That's right. Per the Dodd-Frank regulations, they have to revisit the definition of accredited investor every few years. And the last time they did that, they decided that, they ought not to count the primary residence into a person's net worth, presumably because, the primary residence, is something so valuable that they wouldn't want someone to risk losing it, or have that count to a net worth. They're looking at the definition again, and this time they may r raise some of the thresholds. They may also add some sophistication criteria or quality categories for accreditation as well this time.
So aside from going to your company, which by the way, at the end of the interview, I'll let you tell them how they can get in touch with you about that. What does an entrepreneur have to have that the government would say, yes, you've done the due diligence to make sure that your investors are accredited?
So the test, the standard for doing that, accredited investor verification is essentially one of reasonableness. You must take reasonable steps to verify. And the SEC essentially has, kind of two ways that you do it. One is a principles-based method, which is essentially a loose, fluid, non-objective way of doing it, where you look at the facts and circumstances, you determine that it's reasonable that this person is accredited. Now, that's very convenient for one to be able to argue that they did it properly. However, it's fairly high liability because if you think you've done it properly, but someone else doesn't think you've done it properly, there's room for argument, investigations, lawsuits, etc. So, luckily, the SEC also gave, a few safe harbors. They're not all that fantastic, but there's one in particular that's useful. And essentially, there's three safe harbors I'll discuss because the fourth one's not as practical. One is if it's an individual or natural person investing through income, to determine the threshold of the income, you would look at tax documents, 1099s, W-2s, tax returns, things like that. If it was a net worth investor, then you would look at a credit report. To determine liabilities, you get a written statement to determine liabilities, and then you would look at assets, bank statements, brokerage statements, appraisals, things like that to prove that the assets were there. And if you had done these things, then they would say you've probably done it correctly and reasonably. Still, a lot of room for error by the issuer, especially if they don't do it properly. But there's a third safe harbor, which is pretty solid. And it basically says if a licensed attorney in good standing, or a licensed CPA in good standing, or a registered investment advisor or a registered broker dealer provides a letter certifying that they've taken reasonable steps to verify that the investor is accredited and they believe that the investor is accredited, then that itself is a safe harbor for any company, any entrepreneur relying on Rule 506C to raise capital. They can use that as evidence that they've taken reasonable steps.
That actually makes a lot of sense, because in the case of a lot of people that nowadays are, you know, they have their own businesses, they're generating revenues, they're not on a salary. And of course, one of the things you try to do is minimize the amount of tax you owe by making sure that you, whatever money you're taking in, you're claiming the right amount of deductions for any of a number of things. So this idea that you know, because I would never want to do it based on salary, because, you know, I would really rather go on net worth, because salary doesn't include lots of other things. It's really just looking at your salary. So I like the idea of the third one that says that you can have a lawyer or whoever does your taxes can basically tell them whether or not you have a net worth above $1 million. That's a good idea. If I'm looking now, because we talked a little bit about Title II, three and four, what's involved from an entrepreneur standpoint in terms of legally what do they have to do and what kind of costs are involved in either doing a Title III or a Title IV Type I or Type II?
Yeah, Title III and Title IV are slightly different animals because they allow you to, solicit money from non-accredited investors. Right. And because they allow you to solicit money from non-accredited investors, the laws essentially make it a little bit harder to do, mainly because they need to protect the investors. So Title III is what, you know, people have generally called crowdfunding, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the law firms, the law says this is technically crowdfunding. And let's start with that first. The first thing to understand with this is that you can, right now, under current laws, you can only raise up to $1 million a year. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, every 12 months. Right. So that's not a lot of money. And you can only raise the money through a registered funding portal.
Okay.
Right? So you have to go through these registered funding portals. You can't do it by yourself.
Right.
It's reasonably fast to launch. And the cost is moderate, and you know, you could probably do one in the tens of thousands of dollars, depending on your marketing budget. Mm-hmm. You have a filing circular that is on Form C, which you file with the SEC. And depending on how much money you're raising and whether you've raised money before, you might need reviewed financials or you might need audited financials. It just depends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's reasonably quick. It's reasonably cheap. The downside, of course, is that you still have to go through this process. It's not a lot of money. All the people that are helping you go through this, the funding portal, the marketing person, the reviewed or audited financials, the costs add up. So on a per investor amount you really have to watch to make sure that the money you're raising is at a cost that's appropriate.
Right.
Because between all of that and your ongoing reporting requirements, Title III is economically very, very impractical at the moment.
What kind of reporting requirements are they on a continuing basis?
Very, very basic reporting. It's not anything like a full-fledged a full-fledged reporting that a public company might do, or not even full as much as a Title IV might be able to do.
Right.
In Title IV, which we'll get into now, it's a far more complicated matter, and the cost to do a Title IV up front is significantly higher.
Right. That's actually just like going public. But I guess the thing with Title III that people should remember is you need to calculate in some respects what do you believe your costs are going to be? So how much is the person who's running the portal? What kind of legal and accounting costs are you going to have in order to do the right kinds of things? And if you start to have costs approaching, 30% of what it is that you're raising, you might want to look in a different direction.
Right.
Good. So let's talk about Title IV, because that one gets to be pretty interesting between Type I and Type II.
Yeah, so Title IV is pretty interesting. And Title IV essentially has two parts. There's a tier one and a tier two. And, you know, surprisingly, a fair amount of people have tried to do tier one, notwithstanding the fact that almost every expert agrees that you do tier two instead of tier one.
Right.
And briefly speaking, tier two allows you to raise up to $20 million, you know, each 12 months, whereas tier two allows you to raise up to $50 million each 12 months. And the key with tier two and why most experts say to do tier two is because if you do a tier two, it preempts, it's a federal exemption, but it'll preempt state exemptions.
Okay.
It's a state law, so that states can't make you go and get qualified in each and every state.
Yeah.
Whereas tier one doesn't allow for that. So if you do a tier two, you know, you can go to every state and start raising money from every state, and the amount of regulation each state can have on you to register is minimal. Whereas with the tier one, you'd have to register federally, and then you'd have to do it at each state that you were actually so sitting in.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we've heard recently, although I don't know specifically which states, with the type one, because you have to register in the states, there were states that were coming back and saying that they wanted to have a percentage of the raise, which is really ridiculous, but that's what they're doing. If you want to raise money in the state.
Yeah, anytime you're doing crowdfunding, even if it's Title II, you have to really think about the practicality of what you're doing. A lot of people think, oh, it's crowdfunding. I'm going to let everyone invest, you know, $100. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot of good reasons why you don't want to do that. You don't want that many investors. And two, some of the costs you can amortize out over your entire offering. But some of the costs you can only amortize out per investor. So if you're paying escrow fees per investor, you know, a processing per fee per investor, you really have to be careful that your minimum investment amount is high enough for you to still kind of have a suitable cost of funds.
Yeah, and the other thing is you really, especially with type two, you really have to have audited financials, which are pretty expensive.
Yes. However, one thing to note is that even though Tier 1 Reg A does not actually require audited financials, if you go to the state level and you're trying to qualify at the state often will require audited financials.
Oh, wow.
So it turns out that the people that chose Tier 1 because they thought they didn't need to have audited financials, many of them ended up having to get audited financials anyway.
So the big thing that would come out of this is if you're out there and you're an entrepreneur and you're thinking about raising money, the two choices that seem reasonable for you to look at is one, to go into Title II of just a pool of accredited investors, which seems to be a big pool, or you go to Title IV Type II, which is the lesser of you can raise more money on an annual basis, plus it's a lot less hassle with not having to register with the state you're raising money.
Yes. I mean, in most cases, that is going to be true. And in most cases, the Reg A plus Title IV is actually not going to be as good as, you know, Title II. Sure. And you see it in practice why so many people choose Title II over any of the other ones, right? However, that being said, some people have done very well raising money, you know, using tier one. For example, regional banks that were raising money just from, you know, a tri-state area or something like that. And also the Reg CF, the Title III, you know, not economically fantastic. However, there's good marketing appeal to it. It's reasonably cheap. It's a good way for a company who might not need the money quite as much as they need the marketing.
Right.
To accomplish, you know, both the marketing and the capital raise at the same time.
Well, you know, time flies when you're having a really good conversation, and we're just at about the time that we've got to end the conversation. But I want to give you a chance to tell people if they want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're trying to reach me at the law firm, my email address is jor@homeyerlaw.com. That's HOMEIERLAW.com. For the verify investor, if you're looking for accredited investor verification for your Title II capital raise, the email there is just go to the website there, verifyinvestor.com.
Well, Jor, it's been a pleasure. It was really a good conversation. And I'd like to get you back on and soon to talk about the EB-5. That's a whole nother topic. But I appreciate you coming on the show. And Paul, take us to a commercial.